Sunday, November 30th at 11 p.m., Shug in My Bowl presents Joseph Daly, low brass specialist on tuba, euphonium, and trombone. Join us as we present the second of a two-part discussion with Joseph Daly. That's Sunday, November 30th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
And some loving, oh so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web, Sugar in My Bowls. My name's Joyce Jones, and we're going to continue part two with Joseph Daly, low brass specialist on tuba, euphonium, and trombone. And we're going to start off the program the way we ended last week with Industria from Joseph Daly's most recent release, Wind, Thunder, and Love, a 2014 Joda Music release. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, Sugar in My Bowl, Joseph Daly, happening now.
What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. Sugar in my bowl.
too, the double album set, I said, would be too much. So what I did was I just released the Virtues first, and then the piece with Warren, with the five movements that I wrote for him, with percussion, I released that as a separate CD and then included the Bill Cole tribute. Because Bill was also one of the people that kept me in the business, because what happens is that there's periods of time in the business for every musician, I don't care who they are, where the phone just kind of goes dead. Like, and it might be like a 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 year period. You never know. The phone is just not ringing. You know, I would go to the phone, pick it up, make sure there was a dial.
Right.
There was
right.
nothing coming in.
Right.
But I met Bill Cole at Studio Risby because, you know, he wrote books on John Coltrane.
Yes, and Miles Davis. That's right.
So he would have his book releases down at Studio Risby. So he was having this release party at Studio Risby, and Sam and Bill would always like play. And then Sam said, listen, I, you know, there's a new member of my group, you know, this guy that plays tuba and euphonium and everything. I'm going to give him a call so he can come down, but he can sit in with us.
Mm.
So I was home, and Sam called me, and I came down to Studio Risby and met Bill, and then we played together at his book release party. And then after that was over, a couple of months later, he calls me up, because he was also a professor of music, ethnomusicology and ethnic music at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. So he called me and said he has this 10-part series that he's going to do. He got a grant for a 10-part series called the John Coltrane series, and would I be interested in being part of that? So I said, of course. And I went up to Dartmouth, and I think it was into the third year of that 10-part series. And I did the third all the way to the 10th year. And some years during that period of time, that's the only call I would get the whole year, was that call to go up to Dartmouth and do that project with Bill. So, you know, Bill kind of like just kept me from, because at that time I was teaching, and a lot of people asked me to become administrator, go get my principal's license and take over some school. So at that point, that was pulling on me to kind of do that or remain in the business and everything. And just Bill maintaining those connections where, you know, I knew I would at least have this, and then he would do a couple other projects and everything. And then a couple of little things would fall until, you know, I don't know, people began to realize that my number was this and that, and they began to call me again.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
On these are people that's the whole thing. When I write music and everything, even though I do respect the ancestors that have passed on and gone on, I think doing dedications and writing music for them after they're gone is an admirable thing. But I think it's the better thing to kind of write the music while these people can not only enjoy the fact that you've written a piece of music for them, but they can also be part of the process of participating on those particular pieces. So I was overjoyed that Juan was able to, because, you know, he just turned 80 years old. Just overjoyed that he was able to, still at 80 years old, to be, because it's a very, you know, it's a very challenging, very difficult piece. For him to still to go through all those instruments and play those things just meticulously. And then I was also very happy that Bill, because what I wrote for the Nagaswam is not a chromatic instrument. It's a, most of the instruments of that type are mainly pentatonic, meaning they have like a basic five tones, or they might be able to do maybe a six tone. So, but if you bend the reed and everything, you might be able to get it to do a couple of things. Mm. But to be able to play a chromatic line coming down, descending, like he does on that piece, is very, very difficult for him to do. So when I wrote the piece, we sat down and he had to really figure out some techniques to be able to play that melodic line that comes down chromatically on that instrument that really doesn't have any chromatic tones unless you manipulate the reed in a very, very interesting way. So now that piece becomes like a historical piece for two reasons. But first of all, the person that I wrote it for is on the piece. Then he's also demonstrating techniques on that instrument that someone that wants to play that particular piece on that instrument is going to have to sit down and really figure out how he got around to doing it.
Right.
Same with Warren, too. You know, what he does on the timpani, every piece that he plays timpani on, he's doing things on the timpani that very few other people can even conceive of doing.
Mm-hmm.
anyone that even tries to approach playing those five pieces the way Warren played it, you know, first they have the document to look at and see how he accomplished it. But then they're going to have to sit down and figure out what kind of techniques he used to get these pieces performed in the way he did.
You Know by Jane Cortez. You know, I sure would like to write a blues, you know. A nice, long blues, you know. A good feeling beat to my writing hand, you know. You know, my hand can bring two pieces of life together in your ear, you know. You know, one drop of blues, turning a paper clip into three wings and a bone into a revolt, you know. You know, a blues passing up the stereotype symbols, you know, going into the dark meat of a crocodile and pinpoint the process, you know, into a solo 100 times like the first line of Aretha Franklin, you know. You know, like Big Mama Thornton, you know. I sure would like to write a blues, you know. You know, if I could write me a blues. You know, blues that you could all feel at the same time, on the same level, like a Joe Louis punch, you know? You know, a punch that could break a computer into an event, like Guinea-Bissau, you know? You know, if I could write me a blues, you know, a nice, long blues, you know? An up-to-the-minute blues, you know, a smack-dab-in-the-middle-of-depression blues, you know, a blues without incidental music, you know, without spending time being incidental, you know. You know, if I could write a blues, you know, a blues without the popular use of the word love, you know, without running love, love, love into the ground, you know. A serious blues, you know, a significant blues, you know, an unsubmissive blues, you know, a just because we exist blues. You know, a terrible blues about the terrible, terrible need I have to write the blues. You know, if I could write a nice, long blues, you know, a nice, long blues. You know, it sure would feel good to my writing hand. You know. You know. You know. Yeah.
Now, I suspect that your playing with Bill Cole also opened up your playing with Jane Cortez.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I met Jane through Bill, most definitely. They were very, very close friends.
Yes.
And it was part of that, going up to Dartmouth. She was part of the troupe of musicians that would go up. We were people like Julia Samphill, Dan Rivers, Gerald Beasley, Abdul Wadu. These are all musicians that he would use. Olu Dara. These are all musicians that were part of that troupe that he would bring upstairs to Dartmouth. You got to feel like Dartmouth is, you could imagine us all showing up there. Dartmouth is definitely very, very conservative school.
Right.
So all of a sudden, he would have this series and when all of these really, really pretty radical sounding musicians would just show up and take over the auditorium for a week or so. But Jane was the most intense. She just sat in the back so calm and so beautiful and so serene. And then she'll get up to that podium and click that microphone on, and then she'll just, oh my God, the intensity was just so much. You know?
Right.
It's just the words and the subject matter. She was just so, so intense. It was wonderful.
It's getting harder, harder, harder and harder to survive. This world will bury.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar Levels, name of this program, part two of our exchange with Joseph Daly. What you're listening to right now is It's Getting Harder to Survive with Howard Johnson and Gravity. From Right Now, featuring Taj Mahal, this is a 1997 Verve Motor Music release. And that was Howard Johnson who opened the song. And before that, you heard You Know from Politics, tribute to Jane Cortez, Bill Cole's Untempered Ensemble. That's a 2013 Bill Cole release. And before that, we heard from Wind, Thunder, and Love, Joseph Daly's most recent release. We heard With Percussion, Five Portraits of Warren Smith, Movement 3, and that is Joda Music 2014 release. Before that, we heard It Is Not Other People's Good Wishes Which Make One Rich, But One's Destiny. And this is from Bill Cole's Duets and Solos Volume 2. It's a 2000 Fox Boulder Records release. Oh, and before that, we heard Shadrach, Portrait of Bill Cole from Wind, Thunder, and Love. This is Daly, Daly Music Records 2014. Stay tuned for On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Williams, coming up next. And then more with Joseph Daly on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI on the web.
But thank the God for the inspiration. Now we're gonna pass around the tambourine. We're gonna make a little collection. If we ain't taking care of our business, our future don't have no protection. Nobody giving nothing away. Earn your own keep it, you can say.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for November 30th. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's guest is low brass specialist on tuba and trombone, Joe Daly, who returns for the second part of our interview. If you like what you hear, you can catch him with Hazmat Modine at Terra Blues on Bleecker Street on December 6th and 20th. Details are at terrablues.com. And we have the usual lineup of live music this week. For starters, bassist Christian McBride kicks off a two-week run at the Village Vanguard with his Inside Straight Ensemble from December 2nd to 7th. He returns with a trio from the 9th to the 14th. See VillageVanguard.com for details. Guitarist Pat Metheny wraps up the world tour with his Unity group for a rare week of sets at the Blue Note from December 2nd to 7th. Details are at BlueNote.net. Harpist Brandy Younger has two events this week. She'll be at Harlem Stage on the City College of New York campus on December 4th for a free performance at an event honoring writers James Baldwin and Audre Lorde. Go to harlemstage.org for your info on that. She'll also be the featured artist at Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem for the Jazz Vespers on December 7th. Details are at abyssinian.org. Saxophonist Lou Donaldson leads a quartet at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club from December 4th through the 7th. Go to jalc.org for info. Saxophonist Renee McLean will be at Sister's Place in Brooklyn on December 6th. Go to sistersplace.org for details. Bassist Reggie Workman will be at the Jazz Standard with saxophonist Azar Lawrence's quartet for celebration of Coltrane's A Love Supreme on December 9th to 10th. See jazzstandard.net for information. UPenn professor Dr. Guthrie Ramsey will be at Harlem Stage for a free roundtable discussion on the current state of black music. HarlemStage.org has your information on that. Drummer Michael Carvin will be at Kitano on December 12th to 13th with a release party for his new Flash Forward CD. Go to Kitano.com to find out more. Vocalist Carol Mayard will be at Brooklyn College's Performing Arts Center on December 13th for a holiday concert with the legendary Sweet Honey and the Rock. See BrooklynCenter.org for details. Pianist Randy Weston will be the master of ceremonies for a tribute to saxophonist Renee McLean at the Schomburg Library on December 16th. Information and the necessary free tickets are at sistersplace.org. Lastly, drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria will be at Baruch College's Performing Arts Center with Gene Marlowe's Heritage Ensemble on December 16th. Go to BobbySanabria.com to find out info on that show. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to SugarInMyBowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. WBAI is listener-supported community radio and needs your help to keep it and us on the air. Click the Support WBAI link at sugarinmybowl.org for information on how to support the station. This is Hank Williams signing off. With the new biweekly schedule, we're off the airwaves next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, December 7th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on The Bandstand.
Your mama. Hi, this is Roy Ayers. When I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
So we kind of collaborated with Bill up in Dartmouth, and she heard a couple of things I was doing that was very interesting that she liked, and she wanted to explore it. And then I was able to join her on one of her CDs, and that was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. And I was greatly saddened by her loss. The whole thing is that there are certain people, like, I guess you're familiar with Makonda Ken McIntyre.
Oh, indeed. I was just going to ask you about playing with him during the Liberation Music Orchestra.
Yeah, well, Makonda Ken McIntyre, Jane Cortez, they were like two people, you know, as far as health, mental stability, you know, away from drugs, all that stuff. They were like two people that I thought would just live, you know, on and on forever.
Sure.
So, first of all, Makonda passed away. I was, because like you referenced, we played together with the Liberation Music Orchestra for many, many years. And,
with Charlie Hayden, who's also transitioned.
With Charlie Hayden's Liberation Music Orchestra. So I knew his wife, and that whole, he was part of that whole intellectual circle that would have the lectures around the City College area. Him and his wife were part of that. Just watching him, like I said, I thought he would have a very extensive. I was very shocked to see him. And then later when Jane passed, I was also very, very shocking.
Oh, definitely.
Because she had, both of them did, they both had so many, you see people that have these, like these grandiose plans for, you know, for their life. And,
yeah.
And they have all these wonderful things they want to accomplish. And
have accomplished, exactly.
Yeah. And so it was rough. But playing with Ken in the Liberation Music Orchestra was an amazing experience. There's a lot of stuff on YouTube that's available, and
yes.
you can check out.
And the recordings themselves are available.
But the CDs are available.
Yes.
Also, that we did also. So it was wonderful. It was just, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. Like I said, I'm kind of very blessed with my career. The kind of people I've met, and the kind of people that were able to mentor me, and the kind of musicians that I was being around. Like being around Charlie Hayden is, you know, is another person just so very, very humble, a very, very warm, nice person. You know, he can hear everything. I mean, you get up, you're playing a solo, and then you hear Charlie in the back like, "Whoa, man, that was great."
<Right.
laughs> I mean, that's the most amazing feeling in the world. You're sitting down and Charlie's back there screaming, "Man, oh man, that was a great solo." And I was very, very fortunate to the last Liberation Music Orchestra performance that took place in California, I was able to participate in that, and that was Charlie's last performance with the Liberation Music Orchestra before he passed on. For your listeners, you know, this will be announced very shortly, but on January 13th at Town Hall will be the Charlie Hayden Memorial. His wife is planning it right now, and it's set for January 13th at Town Hall.
Okay, that would be Ruth Cameron, for those who aren't aware.
Yes, so Ruth is planning it right now, and your listeners will be first to be able to lock that date into their calendar. But
excellent.
January 13th. And it's going to be an amazing, amazing evening, because he was a truly amazing musician and
sure.
amazing person.
Oh, yeah. some people may have been lucky enough to have heard Charlie Hayden on Sugar in My Bowl when he was a guest with here with his wife, Ruth Cameron.
Well, like I said, I'm a great admirer of your programming, and I'm so honored that, you know, you've given me the opportunity to speak on little things that I've done. And
little things. There's so much stuff that I want to talk about that we haven't gotten to. One thing being Hazmat Modine.
Okay, Hazmat Modine.
Tell me about that.
Hazmat Modine is one of those groups, like I told you, there was a period of time where things just, the phone was just not, you know, not doing its thing. I don't know if the musicians go in style and out style. I don't know what it is about the music business where all of a sudden you're like the hottest commodity on the block, and the next day, you know, you can't buy a gig, you know, for whatever reason. So anyway, I got a call saying that the band leader's name is Wade Schuman. Wade Schuman, he's looking for somebody to play tuba in his band. He's putting together a band with two harmonicas and guitar, and he's going to sing and drums. And it's going to be a very eclectic-sounding band and everything. And I said, okay, what's the name of the band? I said, Hazmat Modine. So I said, Hazmat Modine. I said, Hazmat Modine, two harmonicas and tuba. I said, this can't go, this not going to last. We probably, you know, maybe have a couple of gigs and that'll be it. But, you know, you never know in this business. I had no idea. He had no idea. No one had any idea that this band would become what it became. It's just a band, you know, people just, when people hear the band, they just kind of love the sound of the band. They love the sound of what he's doing. They love the way he leads the band, kind of showmanship that he does. And it's evolved to a point where it's a pretty major attraction on the European scene.
Oh, okay.
And we're into our fourth album, and the band is going very strong. We're down to Terra Blues twice a month, except when we're out on tour. And we've been there for over 15 years. That's like our home base, still going strong. You know.
And I keep wanting to bring up Pamela Fleming, the trumpeter.
Okay, well, Pamela Fleming, all the members of Hazmat Modine, Pamela Fleming, Steve Elson, Michael Gomez, and of course Pam. We've gotten very, very, very close over the years, you know, with the touring and, you know, being on the road. You know, pretty much living together. You
sure.
Get to know people really, really well.
Sure.
She's really, really, really outstanding musician with an amazing resume. She's done things that I wish I could have done. She toured with Burning Spear. That's one of the gigs I would love to have gotten called for. I mean, you look at her, you wouldn't think that she's had, you know, the kind of things that she's done. She's a fine classical player, fine jazz player, fine classical player, a really good composer, arranger, writer. And she just released a Halloween album. Which is really of Halloween music. Because her block, her whole entire block shuts down on Halloween for a big trick-or-treat thing where all the kids from all the surrounding blocks and everything come into this main block and do all their trick-or-treating and dancing, party and stuff. And so over the years, she developed a band that plays for that particular function. And with that band, she also began to write arrangements. And then she went in the studio and finally cut a CD of the music that she developed over the years for this particular Halloween band and everything. And it's a great, great CD, and people should go looking for it. Yeah, all of our albums are on CD Baby, as all of mine. CD Baby is one of those outlets. It makes it easy for artists to get their music out there to the audience. And if you just go to CD Baby and put my name in or put Pam's name in, and all that stuff will come up right there, how you can access it if you wish to purchase any of it.
And you have a recording on Cicada. It's a little, like, little over 2 minutes or something, but you've got a piece on there that I plan to play during this show.
Oh, yeah. The thing is, with Wade and Hazmat Modine, it's almost like going back to when I was, I told you, when I first, my first Latin gig where you sat down in front of the record player and kind of learned the music.
Right.
Well, Wade, you know, since it's all original music, is we don't sit down in front because there's nothing to reference from a record. But we sit down and Wade would throw out some ideas and everything. And then we would kind of get into it and join in and everything. So what happens is that it's almost like a community type thing, the writing of the music and on most of the selection. Some selection, of course, you know, he comes in and he has a complete idea of what he wants to do. But most of the music that he brings in, he throws it out to the band, and we pick up and contribute where we can. Still, we have a completed song that we're very happy with as far as the arrangement, orchestration, and the way it develops.
By the way, the name of the song is In 2 Years.
Pam sounds great on it. And on that particular song, Wade has a, he's what we call a field recorder, meaning that if he's walking down the street and if he finds he hears something, he'll just kind of pick that up. So the person that shouts In 2 Years is one of his friends. He goes up to Maine for vacation. His family is up in Maine. And he has, in fact, he even has this little island that his mother bought many years ago, that a little private island.
Oh, my goodness.
So that event, there was some type of like firework event and everything. Somebody from one of the neighboring, or either on a boat or something, yelled at him, "I'll see you in 2 years." So he grabbed that off the, you know, out of the air, and he has a tendency to do that, just grab stuff out the air, and then all of a sudden it'll just end up on the record. He'll find a place for it to put on the record. So.
Now, you were playing on there as well, or that was just your composition? I'm trying to figure out.
I'm playing on that, but part of the, the part of the compositional process is for him to just bring music in, and we all contribute, you know, to it.
Oh, okay.
You know, but it's not a piece that I wrote.
Because he gave you writing credit on that.
I got writing credit on that, but I got writing credit on a few other pieces that he's done. But it's writing credit in conjunction with other writers also.
Okay.
So it's not like when I'm doing my project. My projects, you know, I sit down, I structure, I write them. They're pretty much my creation and my visions and everything. But with a group like Hazmat Modine, it's not set up like that. It's set up where even though Wade is his vision and his group, he allows musicians to contribute. And then your contributions acknowledged through sporadic credits.
So you were on a soundtrack, Jelly's Last Jam.
This dive ain't Chicago. Where's my sheep?
Well, now, Jack, before we hit the big time, just want to make sure I still got the touch. I'll show you how to play. Blank folks down Nolan's way. Show you the stylish fingers they have. Ooh, what a noise they make. Stomp till the windows shake. Start mixing, come on and get your licks in. Ooh, 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 that's how you jazz. Now Now, in order to get going what I like to call Sweet Papa Jelly's Jazz, I need a low-down foundation. Can you help me? That's it. Foot in your ass. Good. Can I get some syncopation? That's it. How about some bluesy variation? Can leave the melody to me. Take Buddy Bolden's blues, some Creole curly cues, add some street rag razzmatazz. Oh, that tune struts along, just like it owns a song. And then you hit it with a
tweedy-la-do.
That's how you jazz. And now the tune is going.
Inside a jelly song, sitting down to a meal by your mama after being gone too long from home. Inside a jelly song, standing on some open
the way you go. But knowing it's got to be better than the pain you're leaving behind. Was that song a jealous song? Oh, a head high, a feel good, a strutting low kind of song. A highlight or a low light, you still gotta live life kind of song. And everywhere we went, folks claimed it's at their own. And Jelly's music was like Moses. Hard in the water, paving the way for Chicago.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was part of teaching school. I was teaching school at the same time when I got a call from the contractor for Jelly's Last Jam called me. Yeah, Jerome Richardson. I cannot get a name like
yes.
Jerome Richardson, who,
yes.
Of course, you know, is...
Broadway, Mr. Broadway.
Yeah, well, he's Broadway, you know, he's Pat Jones, Don Lewis. He's like,
yes.
He was one of the top three men in New York for many, many years, mm-hmm. and West Coast, East Coast and West Coast. You know, Quincy Jones, you name it, he played. He was just the number one call for so many things. So he called and said that they're putting together an orchestra for a Broadway musical called Jolly's Last Jam. So I said, okay. So he says, your name, you come highly recommended. First, he gave me rehearsal schedules, and we were rehearsing at Carol Studios. I didn't know who was in the cast or anything, so I get into the elevator, and I'm standing in the elevator, and in walks Gregory Hines.
Oh, yeah.
I'm standing next to Gregory Hines, and I'm trying to be quiet as a mouse. And Gregory turns to me and says, my name is Gregory.
Oh,
I said, oh. And he was such a, oh, man. You're talking about people's hearts dropping when he passed. I mean, that's the way he was for the entire run of Jolly's Last Jam. He was just so friendly with the musicians and cast, so approachable and just wonderful, man. I mean, even though he was a star and everyone knew he was a star, mm-hmm. he knew that he didn't have to prove to anybody that he was a star. He just kind of hung with everybody and was part of the whole gang. He didn't have to, you know, could go through a prima donna type thing, which he never did. And that was an amazing experience with him. That was an amazing orchestra. Just a few names, like, you know, Virgil Jones was in that orchestra, and Stanton Davis, and Britt Woodman, the trombone player from Duke Ellington's band for many, many years.
Wow.
Played trombone, and of course, Jerome played soprano saxophone, and and other instruments, and there are many, many, many more. Linda Twine, she was a conductor, female conductor, conducted the orchestra, and she did a phenomenal job holding all those men together. And Juan was in the orchestra too. Juan's played percussion, and then the bass player that's on all three of my records. I met him, Ben Brown, when we were doing Jolly's Last Jam.
Okay.
It was me, the orchestrator. He would orchestrate, so the tuba and the bass, most of the time, would play similar lines, you know, various. Every once in a while, I would branch off and do something different.
Mm-hmm.
He would branch off. But most of the time, we were playing. So we learned, we kind of like synced up together really well. Because he was on one side of the pit, and I was on the other side of the pit. We would just eyeball each other, and we would, you know. And this guy, Ben, would nail everything, you know. And I knew I couldn't come in there not nailing everything, too. So we would just be nailing our parts together, man. And so we became very, very good friends. So when I began to do these projects, I knew that Ben wouldn't have any problem with the music. So I called him, and I was very fortunate to get him to play on all three of these CDs, Ben Brown. And, of course, the orchestrator was Luther Henderson. I'm a familiar Broadway orchestrator. He's orchestrated just about every, the Fats Waller musical, he orchestrated that one. I know definitely, just about every black musical that comes on Broadway, he's orchestrated. Plus, you know, I'm sure he has a bunch of other Broadway credits, too.
Wow.
But Luther Henderson's. I got a chance to meet some really wonderful, you know, wonderful people in that, you know, besides Gregory Hines, you
mm-hmm.
know, the co-star was Savion Glover.
Right.
It was amazing musical, amazing cast, amazing experience, and it was kind of a life-changing thing because you see these masters. I mean, Gregory would get on stage and he, I mean, even during rehearsal, and him and Savion would just go after each other, you know, tap dancing.
Right.
you know, outside of the musical, man, they would just, you know, they'll just start trading force with each other.
Beautiful.
And, you know, trying to top each other. And the kind of things they were doing just with the tap dancing, and not even the singing, and not even the fact that he's a brilliant singer and a brilliant actor and a brilliant showman. And it's just the tap dancing alone, just the mastery of what those two were doing, is to be able to witness that and be around people with that type of commitment to the art form. It really motivates you to really, every time you hit the stage, to really, you know, give 100% or 1,000%. And everything that I put out as far as my own too, you know, I really spent a great deal of time making sure that it's of the highest production value. Everything is beautifully, meticulously orchestrated and arranged and everything. And it all, you know, all makes a lot of sense. And also, what I try to do is every listening of the pieces that I write, even myself, when I listen to the pieces, every time I listen to it, I hear something different. That's because I really put a lot of work into developing the theme, thematic material, the inner voice orchestrations, which those kind of inner voice orchestrations and stuff, that those are things that you learn from people like Gil Evans and sitting in orchestras like that. You know, because Gil was, that's one thing, Gil, his inner voice writing, and even Howard Johnson's inner voice writing, meaning not what the melody is doing, not what the bass is doing, but what the inner voices are doing. And I guess if you put that in relationship to a choir, not what the soprano or bass is doing, but what the alto and tenor, those two inner voices, or if you have alto, tenor, and baritone, you know, what are those inner voices singing, the lines that they're singing. So sitting, my collective experience of sitting in all those high school bands and orchestras and sitting in orchestras of, you know, Gil Evans and Charlie Hayden and composers and arrangers like Carla Bley, and then learning the roots material from people like Taj Mahal and others. Where Taj is like a walking encyclopedia of American music. There's nothing. Before he would bring us on the four tubas and his whole rhythm section and everything, he would always come in front of the audience and do a solo. He would always start by himself. And every night he would play a different piece from a different aspect of American music. And then if you ever fortunate enough to see him in a solo setting where he's just on the stage by himself, it's just mesmerizing how he can go from style to style. He's just amazing. So, but I'm blessed to be able to say that I know these musicians. Many of them are my close friends, and they quietly brought me to where I am today by example. They did it, and they showed me how it's done. So I'm glad to be doing what I'm doing, and I love playing music. And the people that I've been lucky to embrace me, you know, as a person and as a musician, have been very, very supportive and have really guided me along. Even working with Sam Rivers, because at times we would come in and play a concert. But most of the time it would be like a subscription concert, because sometimes when you go to some of these venues, they have like a subscription concerts where the person would buy out the whole season, so they would show up to every concert. Most of the time they wouldn't know who's on stage or who's going to come perform. You know, they just follow the description of Sam Rivers. They don't know Sam Rivers from anybody else.
Wow.
So we would come in and boom, and Sam, you know, who was very avant-garde. Everything was improvised on stage. There was no talking about the music or what we're going to do or anything. He would just start playing. We would just pick up. We would follow. You know, sometimes play for 2-3 hours like that, nonstop. Wow. And so with those subscription periods, as we were playing, you know, you would slowly see people rising up out their seats and out the door like there's a fire there, you know. You know, but there would always be a group of people that knew who he was and knew what to expect that would stay around. And those people, they would stay till the end of the program. And I have never done a concert with Sam in that setting where we will call back for at least 2 to 3, sometimes 4 stand ovations back and forth. But it can be very discouraging sometimes when you're playing and you see people just getting up.
Right.
People that don't really want to listen, and people that are very closed-minded, people that have a concept of what they think music should be and their concept of what, like some people say, okay, jazz is this. And,
right.
And if it's not this, this is not jazz.
Right. It's like, exactly what jazz is not.
Exactly. That is one of the most open, even the things that I do, because we have people that send these CDs out to different radio stations, and the radio station will get it, and they'll say, even with the Seven Deadly Sins, which I consider, pretty mild in relationship to the stuff that I was doing prior to that. So they would get it and say, oh, this is a little bit too avant-garde for my listeners. And I was saying to myself, how do you know you have a playlist for your listeners?
Yeah.
You gotta give your listeners the opportunity to speak their own mind and their listeners the opportunity to listen to it and say they don't like it. And most of the time that's not gonna happen.
Right.
And even the string album, we sent it out to some radio stations and a lot of people said, well, it's a little bit too, one guy says, well, it's a little bit too stringy for me.
Oh my gosh.
I said, well, how do you think a string album to be for stringy? Another guy, this sounds like classical music.
Mm.
Okay, I said, okay, well, let's give it to your classical music programmer.
Right.
So if you give the classical music guy, the guy said, this is not classical music. What are you talking about? So I said, it's not classical music, it's not jazz, so what is it?
Wow.
So the whole thing is, and I learned this from Sam, I learned this from a lot of people. You write the music that moves you and the music that intellectually you're at that particular point, and people that need to catch up with it intellectually will catch up with it, and
right.
people that don't want to be bothered with, no matter what you do, will not be bothered with it.
Right.
So that's always been my approach, and like I said, all those people that have embraced me over the years have shown me that's the way to go, and that's the way I will continue.
Well, thank you so much, Joe Daly. Thank you for spending all this time with Sugar and My Bowl. I really appreciate your.
Like I said, I'm a great admirer of your programs, and I hope you continue on for a very, very, very long time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again for the opportunity. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Okay, bye.
Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of the program you've been listening to. We continued our discussion, part two of our discussion with Joseph Daly during tonight's program. What you're listening to right now is Sam Rivers' Shockwave from Waves. It's a 1978 Tomato Records release. Before that, we heard That's How You Jazz from Jelly's Last Jam, the original theatrical release. That's a 1992 Mercury Records release. Before that, we heard Into Years, Hazmat Modine. Cicada is the name of the release, 2011 Barbez Records release. Before that, we heard Going Home from Charlie Hayton and the Liberation Music Orchestra from Not in Our Name, a 2005 Verve Records release. Before that, we heard Kosi Sikelele, Africa, Charlie Hayden and the Liberation Music Orchestra from Dreamkeeper, which featured Makata Ken McIntyre and Dewey Redman on the recording. It's a 1991 Blue Note Records release. And stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next as we continue to go out with Sam Rivers. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Thank you.
Hello? Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.